provide a secure, trusting environment. Now, all pastoral care should be the provision of a secure, trusting environment. That means that you must be trustworthy. And you must be a man or a woman of God who brings the peace of God, the strength of God, the power of God, the grace of God, the listening ear of God into every situation in this secure, trusting environment. Well, here's another one which I will just scratch the surface of very, very quickly tonight. So let me flip over, I don't know how many pages, but responding to conflicted families. There are a number of what I would call dysfunctional families within the life of a church. I won't ask you to put up your hand if it's you.
Every head bowed, every eye closed.
I'll let you bury it just for a little while. Types of dysfunctional families that we have. There's the addict family, where there's an alcoholic or chemically dependent family system that's there. Dad's an alcoholic and dependent upon everybody else to play their part, and as long as everybody plays their part, it enables him to stay an alcoholic and the system functions well. As a very dysfunctional system. You know, one of the problems that we can have when the alcoholic gets healed is that it can actually destroy their family. We want to get the alcoholic and we want to get them dried out, we want to get them clean, we want God to touch them miraculously, set them totally free. Well, yeah, we do want that. But if the rest of the family is not part of the journey, you see, families work as a system. And as long as everybody fulfills their part, the system keeps going dysfunctionally, but it still keeps going. And that's their normal. And so if you've got an alcoholic, let's say you've got an alcoholic husband, you will often have a wife who so much wants the husband to get over his alcoholism and be dry, but because she keeps covering for him, it enables him to keep being the alcoholic. And then you've got the children, so she's got her purpose in life is defined by his alcoholism, so she's busy doing her stuff to keep the family afloat, and now she's got worth in life with her family, and then the kids have their particular roles within the family, and then dad gets totally set free overnight. God works a miracle, he's totally free from alcohol, and now you've got the family who don't know what to do anymore. And so it's a whole family journey of recovery here because the system has to change. And everybody's got to go on that journey of change with the one who's being set free. Often overlooked. We're so focused on getting the alcoholic set free that we don't take time to consider the impact of their freedom on the family. And we've got to do both. We've got to take the family on that journey. So we've got this addict family. Then we've got the disturbed family. And this is where there is emotional or psychological issues that impact upon the family system. So, for example, one member of the family may be major depression or schizophrenic or bipolar or something like that. And they tend to become the center of everything that happens or doesn't happen. Parents can't go on a holiday because their adult depressed son or daughter couldn't survive without them at home. And so we could go on and describe the disturbed family in there. And then we've got the abusive family that we've talked about just briefly before our little break there, where there is emotional, physical, sexual or even spiritual abuse taking place within the family. Then there's the legalistic family. And this might be a religious fundamentalist or rigidly dogmatic family system. And sometimes in our world, in our church circles, sometimes this legalistic family is held up to be the model of Christian family. But you scratch below the surface and it's the model of dysfunction and disharmony and bitterness and hatred. With each of these, there are a whole lot of issues that are happening within the families. And in pastoral care, we need to be aware and work through some of the issues that are there in helping them. I've talked about a little with the addict family, some of the issues that are underlying that and the dysfunctionalness of how the family operates, but it operates. And we've got to be able to walk through journeys with them. You add to all of this multi-generational families. That's another whole set of often dysfunctionalness. I remember what it was like when my grandmother lived with us for a number of years when I was an adolescent. And my parents covered things well, shall we say. Until there came the time of great relief and release as Grandma went into a nursing home. Because we each bring our own generational problems with us. For my grandmother, and I, by this stage I was the only one of my siblings that was left at home, and I would spend a lot of time with my grandmother, and here was the strange thing. She'd been in her youth, she was in the Salvation Army. So in her day, Salvation Army introduced movies into Australia, right? You didn't know that, did you? You did? All right. So because the Salvation Army introduced movies into Australia, it was quite okay for us to go to a movie. There was never any question, going to a movie? Oh, fine, that's fine. However, it was sinful to go to the theatre. We had a tennis court in our backyard. But we were never allowed to play tennis on a Sunday. We weren't allowed to kick the football on a Sunday because Sunday was the Lord's Day. As I said, Sunday school at 9:30, church at 11. We never had time to play any sport on a Sunday. The one thing I could never understand, I never quite could work this one out. We could play cards when we were on holidays, but it was sinful to play cards any other time of the year. Some of the stuff. All right. You can add to this one as well, not just the multi-generational, but the multicultural. And where you've got a husband and a wife who are from two different cultures, and they bring their cultures and they blend their cultures, but they don't actually talk about the blending of their cultures, and they don't actually talk about what the values are that they want for their marriage and their family. And they each come into the marriage with different expectations. And then, of course, you've got the children that are born in that marriage who actually grow up in the Australian culture, but at home they might be in a Chinese culture or a European culture, or, and the confusion that there often is with the kids. Sometimes I have parents who bring their adolescents for me to deal with. Guess who I deal with? The parents. So tell me, Dad, what is it that you were doing when you were this age? Well, it doesn't matter. So how are we going to deal with this? What's our pastoral response to all of this? So pastoral care response. First of all, get the information, because there's always two sides to every story. And if you only ever hear one side of the story, don't be quick to judge. See, even where there is physical abuse, I'm walking on thin ice here at the moment, but hear me, stay with me, please. There is never any excuse for a man to be physical with his wife, all right? I say that categorically. There is never any place for physical abuse. However, at the same time, where there is physical abuse, often the wife is needling the husband so much until he can't stand it anymore, and then he lashes out, and then he's the one who ends up in prison. Now, I'm not saying he should do it. He should be let off. No, I'm not saying that. There is never any excuse for physical abuse at all. But there are two sides to the story here as well. And if we take the line of sympathy, we can actually exacerbate a problem rather than help a problem. All right. So hear both sides. And then there's this crisis intervention, which we touched on very briefly last week, and you've got a little bit in your notes about that. And it's a crisis that you intervene. And you've got to be careful. Like I told you about me as a young guy going to the court door last week, didn't I, where there was this domestic going, God's man of faith and power, huh? Stupidity, that was called. I had a few stupid moments in my early youth. You know, I was teaching our young people when I was a young pastor and back in the 70s, and I was teaching our young people how to street witness. And we were down the street, and there was a bunch of bikies, and we had them off one-on-one, and we were really going hammer and tongs. It was great. They were listening until the bikie leader came along. And I was the Christian leader, and he was the bikie leader, and I was on his turf, and he starts kicking me down the street. And I did the most stupid thing I could ever do. As his foot came up, my hand went down. I could have very easily just gone like that, and he would have been on his back, and I would have been 6 foot under, I think. I let his foot go, praise God, for a little bit of wisdom, as I saw this fist coming towards my face. And I knew at this point of time, God was going to put an invisible shield there. His fist was going to smash in. He was going to fall on his knees in repentance and accept Jesus Christ into his heart as his Lord and Savior. And as I picked myself up from the ground and wiped away the blood and went to hospital with a broken nose, I learned a little bit of wisdom in street work. All right, moving right along here now. Refer this dysfunctional family to the professional counsellor. Why? Because the family need you for pastoral support. And the more involved you become with them, the less you will be able to support them in other ways. I think that's an important one. As I said last week, don't ever be afraid to refer. Referring to somebody else is wisdom, not a lack of faith or anything else like that. So let me just flip through. You can read that in your own notes. With any of this, particularly with domestic violence, by the way, if you've got a couple in domestic violence, don't get them in the same room together and try and work with them. Because if you do, you'll probably find that the violent one on their way out will really take the mickey out of the other one, and you've actually exacerbated the problem. Safety of all concerned is primary. And where there is domestic violence, if you've got somebody in your life group who's a victim of domestic violence, they need an escape plan. They need a safety plan. Where to go, what to do, who to ring, a case packed, money available, so that at the drop of a hat, if they need to, they can get out of there. Life is of higher value than the covenant of marriage. And sometimes we have to make an ethical choice here, not a spiritual choice. And the ethic to me is that life is the highest value of all. And I must preserve life more than some of the other things. All right. And then don't try and be Superman, because you'll soon find out that you're not. I once thought I was Superman. I climbed up on the woodshed roof. I put my cloak on and I leapt off. And you can make up the rest of the story. Wasn't a very pretty sight, I can tell you that. All right, I'm going to skip through this one too, because we just won't have time. Let me come back to here. There's an addictive cycle. Let me just touch on this. When somebody has an addictive problem, they didn't get up one morning and say, I think I'll have an addiction today. It usually begins in an accidental sort of a way, an introductory event. And it's often earlier on in life. And so they're introduced to something. Guys with pornography issues don't get up one morning and say, I think I'll get into pornography today. There's been an accidental introduction to it at some point of time in their life that has stirred things within them. And then there are precipitating events that take place within their life. And it might be that their boss looks at them sideways and they feel as though they're a failure. It might be that their wife rejects them. It might be all sorts of things that cause them to you know what I mean by don't you? Yeah. That precipitating event is followed by a preoccupation with it, mulling, chewing over how bad things are. You know, my wife didn't kiss me this morning when I got up. She doesn't love me anymore. And I wonder if she's having an affair. Oh, she doesn't care about me ever. She doesn't care about anything. She didn't even iron my shirts this week. We start to mull on it and it gets worse and worse and builds up within our minds. And then the next thing that happens is a little ritual. You see, they don't usually just go straight to the addiction. They develop this little ritual that they go through. Guys with the internet pornography, that they'll turn on, their little ritual might go something like this. They turn on their computer and they say, well, I might just do a little bit of surfing on the internet for a while. Let me watch the news. So they watch the news and I wonder what's over here. And, lo and behold, up comes the pornography. Oh, how did that get there? Because they went there via their ritual to get there. And then, of course, there's the behavior, the acting out of it, followed by despair, guilt and shame. And of course, the guilt and shame locks them into mulling over it until something happens that breaks this little cycle and they feel okay again and they get on with life. And so the block needs to come in here after the precipitating event. And we actually have to help them to identify the things that are triggers within their life that cause them to begin to go down this ritualistic way of medicating themselves, because that's what all these addictions are. It's just a form of self-medication because they can't handle life and stuff that's happening in life. Pastoral care, encourage counselling, identify purpose and meaning in life, address any toxic faith issues that might be there that drive them into even more a lack of self-esteem, address family behaviours that support the addictive behaviour, support, coach, counsel, encourage, affirm, teach them how to establish boundaries, identify resources that are there at their disposal, and this is an important one. Getting a person off the addiction is 5%. Rehabituation is 95%. And in that process, there will often be many relapses. Remember, we go around this circle of change that we introduced last week. And with somebody where there has been an addiction, there will be many, many times around that circle of change before they come out the other end, maintaining the change that's taken place within their life. All right. We're on this little final stretch here now. A few little let's put it in brackets, legality, or in inverted commas, legalities, because it's not as if there is an act of parliament that says this is what's required of you as a pastoral care worker. However, there are a few things to keep in mind in order to provide ethical pastoral care. Sadly, it's not uncommon to find people who have been grossly abused by churches. Yet the church should be the most caring place in the community. So integrity of ministry goes beyond simply not abusing people. It addresses the very motivation for being a pastoral carer, for being in some form of ministry. Some people want to get involved in pastoral care for very selfish reasons. They like other people dependent upon them. They like the ego of being able to help people. They want to give back to others because they've been helped at one point of time in their life, but they now they've taken it as their thing that they've got to do. And or it might be that they have the need to be needed. Or sometimes people are so looking forward to self-help but are in denial. And so they reach out to try and help others in order to help themselves. Our motives, there should only be one reason, one motivation to be involved in pastoral care. And that's the recognition that God has called us to care for one another as he has cared for us. That should be our one motivation. Because there sure ain't no glory in it. That's a lot of hard work when we do it well. So ethics is about what's acceptable and competent in the way we go about our pastoral care. And so in that, there are five underlying principles of professional ethics which we should adhere to, and churches should adhere to them. And if every church adhered to it, we wouldn't be having the commission that's going on at the moment. All right? So five underlying principles of ethical behaviour in pastoral care. First of all is the autonomy of the other person. Their right for self-determination and freedom from the control of others. We're not here to control people. We're here to help people and care for people. And as I said last week, people need to make decisions for themselves. We're not there to make decisions for them. And they're responsible for the outcome of their life. We're responsible for the way we come alongside of them and support them through their life. All right. The second one is non-maleficence. That's a hard word to say. You've just got to let it roll off your tongue. Non-maleficence means that we do no harm to people. And then the other one is beneficence, which means we only do good. What we do, what will benefit the person. So they have freedom to choose for themselves, so we can offer things to them. But we can't make them take it on board. And if you try to, you end up abusing them. So we offer things. And they have the freedom to embrace it or not. And they are responsible for the outcome of their own life. Then we won't do anything that's going to cause them harm. So we've got to be careful about what we do and how we do things. We will only do things that we see are for their benefit. And then fourthly, the issue of just, let me back up to non-maleficence and beneficence is where the concept of duty of care comes in. Duty of care is a legal term, but unfortunately it's not very clearly defined for us. It means doing whatever is necessary to ensure that those we're responsible for are properly handled. And at law, it's what would a reasonable person in your position or below be expected to do. So if you're the senior minister, you have a greater expectation put upon you than if you're the life group leader. You haven't got the same level of responsibility, no matter what your professional life is outside. When you come in to be your life group leader, that's the level of responsibility that you have. And be careful that you don't try and push yourself beyond where you are and become the professional to the group, to your people. Be their friend, not their professional. All right, moving right along here now. So duty of care is relative to our position. Then we've got this issue of justice, and that involves fairness, equality in access and care and resources. Acts 20:28 says, care for all the flock that God has put under your care. It's all of them, even those that drive you batty, get up your nose and irritate you, cause you to want to punch their lights out. God cares for them just as much as he cares for you. And justice, this principle of justice, says that we're going to care for everyone in our life group to the same degree. Not have favorites that are in here. And then finally, the principle of fidelity. Keeping our promises, our commitments, honesty, loyalty. Because of the bond of trust between you and those that you care for, fidelity is actually essential for effectiveness. Trust, once it is lost, is extremely difficult to rebuild. And it's easy to lose trust, but awfully hard to gain it. In this, we've got the issue then of confidentiality as well, and I briefly mentioned this a little bit last week too. This is perhaps the least kept thing in church life. This tendency to be sticky beaks and gossip mongers, all in the name of pastoral care. Prayer meetings to support people. Well, confidentiality is the obligation to protect the privacy of both the people and the information that they share with you. That's pretty simple, isn't it? However, there are limitations to confidentiality. Where someone's life or property is in danger, we don't have to keep confidentiality. In fact, we shouldn't. We become complicit if we complicit with it, if we know. There was a case in the paper a couple of years ago of a young graduate psychologist or a student psychologist, I can't remember which, who was working in a prison system, and the prisoner that they were working with told them that as soon as they got out, they were going to, I don't know what it was, go and murder somebody or rape somebody or something, rather I don't remember the full story. And this young psychologist had been so taught about confidentiality but had not been taught about the duty to warn. And so held on to that information. And unfortunately, the prisoner went and did what they said they were going to do. And the information should have been passed on, because in those situations, you do not keep the confidentiality. When life or property is in danger, essentially, that's the bottom line. Or when they give you permission to share, you can go and freely talk about it. So, yeah, if the pastor comes to you and says, what did they talk to you about? You know what the best thing today to do is? Why don't you go and ask them? Or you say, I really can't say until I check with them that they're happy for me to share. Because if you breach their trust, and I'm not suggesting that your pastors are going to do stupid things with the information. It has been known in other churches. I'm not suggesting here. Please don't stone me yet. But sometimes information has gotten its used a little bit more freely than what it was thought that it was going to be used, and it will come back to bite you. So when one of your life groups shares something with you, you say, you know, that's really important, that it's something that the pastors really should know. Would you allow me to just talk with them, because I don't really know what to do here to help you right now? Would you give me permission to go and talk to them about this family issue that you've got? Or it might be, hey, listen, I think you should go and make an appointment with Knox Community Care Counsellors and deal with this. And you pass it on in that way. Right, so there are limitations. So this duty to warn is a tricky thing to apply, but if there's an endangered party through the threat to life, including suicide or property, there's a duty of care to warn the endangered party, or in the case of suicide, to warn the family, other family members or other responsible people. However, there is often a threat against you if you do. And so you've got to be wise in the way you go about things and try as hard as you can to get permission to do it. But if they won't give you permission to share that they're going to go and top themselves, then don't keep it confidential. Go and pass it on to those who are able to deal with it and help. All right. In our last couple of minutes that we've got, I highlighted a comment here. As a general rule, whatever information you collect can only be used within your church as clearly indicated to the congregation before it is gathered, and can't be disclosed without consent, because you have a privacy statement and there is a privacy act to which we are all bound as organisations. There's a Commonwealth Privacy Act, the Victorian Informations Act, Victorian Health Records Act, and we actually come under all of those in things that we do. All right, information we collect. The art of staying sound. I've often said you've got to have rocks in your head to be a pastor. So I was one. Speaks for itself. We can never avoid stress or conflict when we're in the people helping industry. How we handle it determines the outcome. Burnouts are a common phenomena in ministry, very prevalent in the helping ministry. It's emotional, spiritual, and physical exhaustion. And true burnout is rarely fully recovered from. Most people who come to me and say, oh, I'm burnt out, Ian, they're not burnt out, they're exhausted and they need a holiday and they'll come back refreshed. But when somebody is really burnt out, it can take anything from 5 to 10 years to recover to about maybe 80% of what they were before. Don't go down the journey of burnout. So burnout is loss of enthusiasm, loss of energy, idealism, perspective, and purpose. It's a state of mental, physical, and spiritual exhaustion brought on by continued stress. Actually, its biggest cause is trying to live up to expectations that are beyond your capacity to achieve. And to do that, having to do backflips with your personality traits such that you get totally depleted of emotional energy. High expectations on us can be enormously damaging things. It's where we need to understand our own capacities and need to ensure that we're not aiming for the idealistic that we talked about briefly last week. Bringing it back to reality. Okay, so here's a little comic thing. I don't know, it just seems to me that if the sound of falling leaves is making you edgy, then your stress levels are definitely too high. Here's another one. A herbal remedy for life ache. You suffer from life ache. Your whole life is sore. It hurts when you move it. Herbal remedy? Take a patch of grass, a mild day, and two large green trees. Lie on the grass beneath the trees and contemplate the other tree. Nap from time to time or graze occasionally at the grass. Pain will subside. Life ache cannot be cured, but you can learn to manage the symptoms. So, first thing we've got to do if we're going to survive is be realistic. And there are three sources of unrealistic expectation that come upon us. First of all, there's self-imposed expectations. Romans 12 says, don't think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. Understand yourself, and know your capacities and your limitations. You say, how do we know? Well, we tend to go a little bit beyond them at times, and when we do, we need to be able to be wise enough to say, whoa, I need to back off here. So we have self-imposed expectations. Then we have expectations imposed on us by others. Those in your life group have expectations of you. You better live up to them. Boy, you'll be out in your ear because they'll tell the pastors. They haven't been good life. Yeah. The pastors. The stuff that they have to put up with from you lot and everybody else as well. Because everybody is good at putting expectations on others that they never actually identify and say, well, this is what I expect from you. They don't say that. They just tell you when you haven't lived up to them. So we have to be careful of the expectations that are imposed on us by others. And then finally, there is our expectations of others, because just as others impose expectations on us, we impose expectations on others. And when they don't live up to them, we feel as though they've let us down. And then we get all grumpy with them. And we get sad. And that sad turns to anger. And the anger turns to revenge. And we want to kick them out of our life group. Well, it's not about kicking them out of their life group. It's about working through some stuff ourselves and have realistic expectations of others, because they can't do everything that you can do, nor will they do it the same way that you do it. Secondly, we need to establish some boundaries. Most pastoral care workers are really conscientious because they care. That's why you do pastoral care. That's why you're a life group leader, because you care. There's also a tendency to be compulsive workers, because the work of caring never, ever, ever comes to an end. People's problems never get totally solved, and there are always the needy amongst us. And so the tendency then for us in pastoral care is to sacrifice our own life and our family at the expense of those we're trying to care for. But if you sacrifice yourself and your family, you won't be fit to care for anybody else. And so we need boundaries that are in place. It's easy for care workers to turn into workaholics, whatever field it is. Sometimes we're driven by guilt, and I've had people that come to me, you know, God expects more from me. No, God doesn't expect more from us. God expects far less than what others expect of us, and usually a lot less than what we expect of ourselves. Much less than what the pastor says. Oh, no, I'm not allowed to say that, am I? God doesn't have high expectations of us. Matthew 25, the parable of the talents. You know the parable. To one he gave, the master gave five, to another two, to another one, and then he went on his journey. The key verse in Matthew 25 is verse 15, where it says, he gave to them each according to their ability. He never gave them beyond their capacity to handle. So the one who went and buried his talent in the ground actually had the capacity to work with it and do something with it, but he just didn't because he was afraid of failing. the master, when he comes back, he never commends the two that doubled their talents for doubling it. He never said, well done, thou wonderful workaholic who doubled what I gave you. What did he say? Well done, thou good and faithful servant. All you've done is what you were able to do. He never commended them for their profit. He only commended them for their faithfulness. And God will only commend you for your faithfulness, not how many notches you got on your Bible. All right. We have to manage our time. Well, you ever got to the end of the day and you feel like you've achieved nothing? You know, you're like the farmer who goes and ploughs his paddock and then he finds that the tractor needs oil, and as he's going to oil the tractor, he sees the pigs aren't fed, and then he sees the sack that reminded him of the potatoes that had started to sprout. So, and as he went past the wood pile, he remembered that his wife had told him that he needed to bring some wood in, and then he picked up the axe, but it was blunt, and then he went into the... And he gets to the end of the day and he hasn't even started to plough his paddock yet. Well, Acts 17:25 says that time is a gift for us. Don't abuse it. Psalm 139:16, time is limited, so don't waste it. Psalm 90:12, time's very precious, so use it wisely. We must make time for all that God asks us to do, but not what others ask us to do if it conflicts with our boundaries. In order to identify boundaries, what you firstly have to do is identify your true values in life. Because when you, as a family, have a set of values, you're able to then assess every situation according to your values, and at the end of the day, you live according to your values. And you make decisions according to your values, and it actually becomes easy to make decisions because you've got a set of values that are your guiding principles that are there. Sit down and identify your values. All right, moving right along. Fourthly, embrace your personality. Some people are racehorses and some are turtles. Know yourself. Be yourself. Now, often we stereotype the perfect pastor, but you know, I've tried to look for the commonalities in assessments across pastors, and really, they're all of different personality traits. There is no perfect person who can be a pastor, who can be a pastoral carer, who can be a senior minister, but there is a calling in God. All right, so embracing your personality. Personality doesn't necessarily impact what we do, but it certainly impacts how we do it, understanding ourselves in there. All right, then handling criticism, because there will be criticism along the way. You can't avoid it, and there will be a measure of truth in every criticism, but just don't let it overwhelm you. And then spiritual awareness. We must never overlook the fact that we're involved in spiritual warfare. So ensure your life is well-rounded, take regular time off, learn to say no, develop prayer support, find a confidant, enhance your marriage, because if your home is good, you can handle anything else. If your home is bad, it doesn't matter how good anything else is, it won't work for you. Regular prayer, Bible study, keep learning, keep healthy, keep a sense of humour, because ministry is a marathon, not a sprint. Good night, God bless you.